My name's Buffalo Bill and you're listening to The Bike Show on Resonance FM.
You're listening to The Bike Show on Resonance 104.4 FM. And this week on the show, I've come down to sunny Sevenoaks to meet with Graham Fife, author, historian, broadcaster, who's just got a new book out, and we're going to be talking about that and talking about his life in cycling, which is also the subject of the book. Welcome to the show, Graham.
Welcome to Sevenoaks.
Is it always this sunny?
No, it isn't. No, when it's sunny, this house faces directly south, so I get the full benefits. Great.
And so this is the centre of your cycling world in North Kent that you describe with some love in your book. Where are we going to go for a little spin today?
We're going to head out towards Plaxtoll, which is where I meet my particular friend Luke. That's our convenient midway point. It's a bit hilly towards there, up to look over towards the Weald. But it's from here 5 minutes and we're in quiet country lanes. It's great. I love it. This is the hub of my cycling world in England, and I couldn't have been luckier to have found it.
All right, well, I'll follow you.
Okay.
Quand on partait de bon matin, quand on partait sur les chemins, à bicyclette, nous étions quelques bons copains. Il y avait Fernand, il y avait Firmin, il y avait Francis et Sébastien, et puis Paulette. Nous étions tous amoureux d'elle, on se sentait pousser les ailes, à bicyclette. Sur les petits chemins de terre, on a souvent vécu l'enfer, pour ne pas mettre pied à terre devant Paulette. Faut dire qu'elle y mettait du cœur, c'était la fille du facteur, à bicyclette. Et depuis qu'elle avait 8 ans, elle avait fait en le suivant tous les chemins environnants, à bicyclette. Quand on approchait la rivière, on déposait dans les fougères nos bicyclettes. Puis on se roulait dans les champs.
Well, we've just come up the first hill. North Kent, known for its hills, but we were shadowed all the way by a rather timid removals van who couldn't decide whether he was coming past us or not. And here we are, certainly out of the suburbs.
Yeah, first sight of the country. It's great. I mean, that little hill always kills me. I can't do them quick anymore. And being with somebody that much younger and fitter, of course, is always a cheerful reminder of that very fact.
He lies.
But here we look out beginnings of orchards and hop fields. The hop fields are dying away a bit in Kent, sadly. But, you know, this is a lovely little road. Just along here is a place called Stone Street. I mean, a clutch of houses, not very much more. I used to get loads of apple logs from the farm there. And this is my arterial route out into the further wilds of Kent.
And so turning to your book, you've written lots of books. You've written books about cycling, books about the Tour de France, books about the history of the French Terror. And probably other things that you were written under pen names that you won't divulge on the bike show. And I won't press you on that. But what made you think about writing what is essentially a very personal memoir?
Well, I suppose it's the accumulation of all the work that I've done writing about cycling from the Tour de France book. I mean, people say to me, why that? And I say, well, it combines a passion, a passion for the bike, but an intellectual passion too for the history of the Tour and, you know, the epic event that it is. And I've written quite a lot recently which has been constrained necessarily by historical fact, accuracy and all the rest. And I very much wanted to write this book because, hey, I'm a freelance, I need the work. But it's very personal to me, and I hope that doesn't make it kind of introspective. It's certainly not that in my view. But it was to cut loose, to write from my head and my heart about something that I love, and it ranges widely beyond just the two wheels as we stand here, you know, astride the bikes. Of course, that's what brings us together. But I'd say, Jack, really, this book, for me anyway, is a celebration of friendship. Above all, a celebration of friendship, you know, a sense that that's the core of our being and existence. Without friendship, we are very little.
Well, that sounds very positive. But the opening chapters of the book describe a childhood which not necessarily always had you a smiling, carefree child. Tell me about growing up in Finchley in North London.
Well, it wasn't happy, as you'll see from the book. And the pity is that I was actually a happy little chap. I did smile a lot, and that created its own problems. I really survived it, and the portrait of my father is true, and he died recently, and of course the emotions are complicated there, but I've tried to be as honest as I could be, a man much afflicted. And so I got through it with the help of my grandparents, friends and all the rest. But I think that what comes out of it is a sense that there was always my own being in there somewhere, that no matter what was going on round about me, survival was important, of course, but keeping the spirit intact. And, you know, I learned to lie and deceive and not be found out, all that kind of stuff. You know, I suppose somebody said to me, you know, like a spy, I don't know about that, but to emerge at the other end and say, hey, well, you know, to quote the Nietzsche, what doesn't kill us makes us stronger.
And you weren't a kind of big childhood cyclist. You had a bike, you had bikes, but it wasn't your kind of passion, at least from the description you give of it in the book. How did you come to a love for the bicycle, and was there something deeper in your character that you felt that the bicycle met a certain need, or was it a purely utilitarian thing?
Well, to begin with, it was utilitarian. It got me further away and faster than I could walk or run. Yeah, I mean, it's interesting that the two sports which have animated me most profoundly are cycling and rowing, both where you can sit down. Whether this says something about my innate indolence, I'm not sure. But it was rowing, certainly, at university, which really triggered what I celebrate now every time I go out on a bike, even when it's just shopping. It is that thing of pushing yourself beyond the limit of what's comfortable, which I did on the river habitually, day after day after day, hour after hour. But I found on the bike something unique beyond that. That is, I suppose, what unites us all, that you are on the bike by yourself, whether in company or just riding alone. And you can do what you want. You can push yourself that further. And, you know, as the book explains, that the bike introduced me to an exploration of something wider beyond just the immediate experience of doing something which hurts like hell, very satisfying, okay, on the river. But on the bike, there is that extra dimension, what you see, what you hear, the people you meet, and, okay, sure, being inspired by the Tour de France.
I came, in a way, to taking cycling a little bit more seriously through doing rowing at university, and it's definitely that combination of pushing yourself and feeling that kind of sense of slight abandon when you've gone a little bit too far perhaps, and you know it's going to take yourself a little bit of time to recover. But somehow, I don't know whether it's just a simple fact of endorphins in the body, but somehow it makes you feel good. And the limiting factor of rowing is that you've got to go up and down this river. And you go up and then you go down and you go up and then you go down. And you've got 3 or 4 or 7 or 8 more people in the boat that you have to be organised and corralled into doing it too. But the bicycle is, as you say, solitary, can be solitary. It doesn't have to be solitary, but it can be. It does work alone. But more importantly, you go somewhere. You have freedom to go somewhere. Do you take that road to the left or that road to the right, which is something that rowing doesn't really allow you?
No, I mean, if rowing is a very different compression of your physical and mental effort, and the need for coordination with other people, especially, you know, with 7 other people, 3 other people, and they never turn up on time. Of course, there's an added frustration in that. You do get on your bike and you're out there. But I think, you know, not to be highfalutin about it, it's the inner life, what goes on in your head too, that I find most stimulating about the bike. I mean, a while ago I made a radio program for the BBC, and in the course of it interviewed Alan Bennett, and he played a very straight bat. He wouldn't be drawn on a bike. He rides a bike, utilitarian. And I said, don't you ever find that, you know, when you're working, you need to get away? And just the other day I said, you know, I went out on the bike and I got stuck on a bit of work and, you know, things bubbled up. And he looked at me and he said, no, I'm afraid things don't just bubble up. It's more or less a constant grind. But for me, it is absolutely that thing of, you know, I can be absolutely worn out at the desk and I think, I've got to get out of here. I get on the bike for 10 minutes, I feel awful. I think, what am I doing? What am I doing? And then it starts to loosen up. And that's, you know, setting the brain free, the imagination roaming. And it's exactly what you're doing. It's part of the rhythm of riding.
Well, about a year and a half ago on the bike show, we had a psychologist on the show talking about brain states. And she said that if we're constantly stuck in a beta state of multitasking, it's very difficult to have creative or original problem-solving thoughts. Whereas if you get into an alpha state, which you can get into through walking, swimming or cycling, kind of repetitive physical activity, your brain is set free. So there is science behind that.
Let's get into the alpha state. I'm all for that thing of just stepping away from the hard work. You know, you've got to do it. You've got to sit at the desk and face that machine. But almost, you know, for some people, it would seem like a risky business, stepping away, saying, but, you know, you're going to lose it. You're going to forget things. I say, no, that's where you find the stuff, in those vacancies, apparent vacancies.
Well, let's continue on and try and avoid getting run over by rather expensive cars that seem to be going past.
It's Kent, man. Like barley, and then there's a wooded ridge, and on top of that is a One Tree Hill, which is what the book was going to be called originally, because it's very steep and it's very unpleasant. It's got a good ring to it, One Tree Hill, and it was turned down because apparently it's a television program. Well, I don't have a television, so I wasn't to know. I mean, my daughter might have told me. There we are, didn't matter. I've found Cinder Hill, which is further away from here, but that's, this is the, well, one of the routes towards it. You'll read about that in the book. And we go into a bit of a hedge-lined road here. And to the left, there is a very ancient mixed woodland. This area here is very close to the Pilgrim's Way, which is the route used by pilgrims to Canterbury, the shrine of St. Thomas a Becket. And these woods here are crisscrossed by old tracks used by peddlers. You know, originally this whole area would be woodland, and
this would have had any of the iron workings that, at least the southern Kentish Weald is known for.
I'm not sure if this far north, Jack. Maybe, but I don't know about that. But you certainly, I've walked through here.
And it's all overgrown coppice, isn't it, really?
Yeah, yeah. But there, you know, there are maps which you can go, you know, go walking off-road. I haven't ridden off-road. But they are fine, fine tracts of woodland. And you do really feel that you're tramping the ancient ways. Just going up a little rise here, and we're dropping down into Stone Street, which betrays its Roman origins, because that's what it would have been, a Roman road. The Romans were here in quite serious force. And just up ahead, you can see there's a hop field there.
Right, we need to go in single file. We're being passed, I think.
Okay. So here we are at the top end of Stone Street. We've just done a bit of a loop, and a good long view for the start of the Weald.
So will the Tour de France Stage 1 come nearby here?
It's coming to Tunbridge, and so we're going to pick a lunch spot, of course. Very important to follow the tradition of the Tour and see it from the side of the road. I've yet to pick an exact position, but it'll be out in the country somewhere.
So you won't be in the car with Jean-Marie Leblanc?
No. No, although Luke...
The pork butcher, as he was famously described by right? Johnny Green in his book on the Tour de France.
Oh, right, yeah. Luke is actually almost certainly going to be right driving the motorbike for Graham Watson. I said, hey man, you're going to miss lunch.
It is all about waiting and enjoying.
Yeah. I think it's going to be great. Just recently, riding these lanes, the buds bursting, you get that wonderful balsam fragrance. It's a lovely moment of the year as the spring takes hold. Let's go left here again.
Now, in your book, you kind of bare your soul. You know, it's all the stuff about when things weren't going so well. Quite a lot of oblique references, and sometimes not so oblique, to personal life, the women that you have known, in all the ways that it's possible to know women.
Well,
how
yet,
comfortable
Jack,
were
yet.
You to do that?
I think one of the consequences of my childhood was that I closed up on myself. I mean, I had big conversations with myself, but I'm essentially, I think, candid and open. One goes on learning about oneself, and that's important. But I think one of the most important aspects of my writing life has been to snap the locks clear, snap them free, and open myself. And this is the first occasion when I've really been able to do that, and I felt entirely happy about it. I mean, I'm not dishing dirt, I'm not being rude, I hope, and I'm not being sensational. It's as it was that I can recollect, and as it struck me at the time. And as I say, a few names mentioned, okay, but nothing more to hurt. That's important.
Got a bag by the name of Tibby. Cutest thing you'll ever see. I got a bag by the name of Tibby that my mama bought for me. Got to grease all the old ball bearings, or want no rust on them at all. I want to ride on the old ball bearings, so I'll never, never stall. I ain't pumped till in a long time, but I'm gonna pump till tonight. I'm going to bump Tilly right down the line. I'm going to ride Tilly out of sight. When I put on my brand new rubber, she'll ride so doggone smooth. I must put on my rubber, then old Tilly's in the groove. I ain't pumped Tilly in a long time, but I'm gonna pump Tilly tonight. I'm going to pump Tilly right down the line. I'm gonna ride Tilly out of sight. The name of Tilly, the fastest thing I ever rode. 'Tis my bike by the name of Tilly that can carry such a load. Now I ain't pumped Tilly in a long time, but I'm gonna pump Tilly tonight. I'm gonna pump Tilly right down the line. I'm gonna ride Tilly out of sight. I ain't rang her bell in a long time. I'm going to ring her bell tonight. I'm going to tighten the screws on Tilly and ride with all my might. Now I ain't pumped Tilly in a long time, but I'm going to pump Tilly tonight. I'm going to pump Tilly right down the line. I'm on the ride out of time.
Well, we've returned back to Casa Fife, and Graham has kindly put some lunch on the stove, and we have a couple of beers open, and I just want to ask you a bit about the Tour de France, and from why did you get a passion for the Tour de France?
I don't know, Jack. I suppose it coincides with my friendship with Laurence, because that was the early 70s, and it's when I started riding a bike again seriously, well, riding it seriously for the first time, I suppose, because I got ill, a lung infection. That's when I started saying, hey, I've got to get stuck into this. And I was friends with a guy, Roy Wyman, who had ridden as a pretty good amateur at high level, and he talked about the tour, and so it, you know, I suppose it just struck a chord, and
it wasn't on TV or really carried in the newspapers in those days.
No, I remember
it was very exotic.
I mean, in early, well, mid 70s, you got 10 minutes on a Saturday lunchtime on the sports coverage of the Tour de France. That was it. So there was nothing. I mean, in the Cycling Weekly, the comic, you know, did a bit of it, but it didn't. It all was a bit parochial, and I suppose it was getting in touch with that cycle journalism in French that I suddenly thought, wow, this is a bit special. This,
because it's a different approach.
Well, I think yes. I mean, because it's a long, long tradition. Of course, road racing is absolutely it for them. It had been going on for, well, not quite a century then. I mean, 70 years, but it was the big race. In those days, even more so, the sense that here was this amazing sporting event going out across the hexagon of France, appearing in tiny little villages. I mean, I remember riding through a village on my way to see Laurence one time, somewhere in remote countryside, and kids gathering at the side of the road, going, vas-y, poupou, you know, I mean, just the enthusiasm.
But beyond that, how does it become a mystical experience?
I suppose we're getting into the realms of metaphysics here, you know, extending the what I was talking about earlier, you know, the sporting event to, well, the great epic. I mean, if you like, it doesn't encapsulate it, but it gives some idea. Henri Desgrange, who founded the Tour de France, said the ideal tour for him would be a race in which only one rider had the endurance, determination, and physical wherewithal to survive. You know, so we are talking about, you know, not to put it too grandly, but Aeneas's descent into the underworld, the parallels, you know, the metaphors of, you know, going as far as the human spirit can possibly endure to go.
And suffering, and glory through suffering.
Absolutely. There's, I mean, you know, there's...
How do you get glory through suffering?
You know, the word travel comes from the word travail. It's to do with working. It's putting yourself through something to discover something. And our self-knowledge, you know, gnothiseauton, written up at the Adelphic Oracle, that is what is important about ourselves. And we each find our own way to do it, you know, saying of somebody who never rides a bike, they're never going to find out about themselves. Of course, that's nonsense. For me, it is exploring my own physical capacities, but also the mental, you know, driving yourself and saying, no, I can keep going. That's what the Odyssey is about. I mean, Odysseus loses his friends. He has to keep going. And I read classical Greek at Durham, and the repeated phrase, Odysseus pushed down the grief in his heart and he put his hand to the steering oar. You go on, no matter what affliction you have encountered, you go on. And, you know, in a small way, in a microcosm, that's the Tour de France.
And what kind of state do you think the Tour de France is in today? We've just seen last week the arbitration hearing of Floyd Landis fighting against the failed drugs test. We have every week, it seems, a new star confessing in a tearful way that they attempted doping or that they doped once a very long time ago. Has doping spoiled the tour for you?
No, it hasn't. It's overshadowed it, of course. One can't pretend otherwise. And the fiasco last year was really horrible. I hope that the tour organisation and the other ruling bodies will come to some agreement as to saying, look, if people dope then and they come clean, then we can be lenient. I think what has happened is that there's these twin reluctance, first on the part of the riders to admit to doping. You know, it goes on for years. Virenque, for instance, you know, going, oh, for God's sake. And then on the part of the authority saying, well, you know, we're going to hit you, we're going to crush you. They need to come to some kind of accommodation. It's gone on for a long time. EPO changed everything. We know that. But I do believe that cycling has been an easy target because it's always happened, you know, people masking fatigue. I don't justify it, but it has happened. But I know one physician who is a consultant with the Olympic Committee, and she said, what is happening in cycling is happening across sport. How many footballers get tested even? This is not to excuse the cyclist, but we need to be upfront about it. Let's come clean on all sides of this and say, okay, it's going on, but let's handle it. Not turn it into a fight.
And is there anything that the media can do?
Well, I think the media have, you know, there's a kind of prurient interest, and also they're ducking the issue now and then. You know, they want the sport to survive because it's going to sell the magazines. I mean, I know, and no names, no pack drill, that, you know, the circulation numbers in with magazines has plummeted. Television, German television, saying, you know, we wanted to sponsor a sporting event, not a pharmaceutical shop window. It's damaging them, but their interests are commercial. So it's a complex business. But I think the journalists have, you know, everybody, it's not a single answer. Everybody has got to be in, you know, some kind of consensus across and saying, look, it is important for us to divvy up on this. It happens, but we need to address that it is happening.
That was Graham Fife, whose new book, The Beautiful Machine, A Life in Cycling from Tour de France to Cinder Hill, is out now in hardback, published by Mainstream and available in all good booksellers, as the saying goes. Well, that's the end of the show for this week. Next up on Resonance 104.4 FM is The Clear Spot. But from me, Jack Thurston, until next week, chapeau and bonne route.